loan market association standard documentation. The most important of the LMA, loan market association documents, is the multi-currency term and revolving facilities agreement. This is called the NTR. The LMA.NTR. Whatever the year is or whatever the code number is for this. The LMA is the principal trade association in the loan market area, including the secondary finance area. We will come on to talk about loan transfers, how we can transfer rights and obligations under loan agreements. Although traditionally loans are for a term, a fixed term, there's also a secondary market, an active, powerful secondary market in these instruments, and we will look at the various types of means that we can use legally to transfer them, either by legal and equitable assignment or by novation, and we will see how in the annexes attached to these documents all the standard form documents are already provided. So we're looking at the loan market association standard provisions. The loan market association is based in London. It's actually at 11 Upper Bank Street in Canary Wharf in London. We have a number of separate financial centres. We have the old City of London, the main City of London. We have Canary Wharf, which is effectively the investment banking centre. We also have in the West End, around Chelsea, Kensington, Knightsbridge, we have all the boutique institutions, all the hedge funds and private equity firms tend to be around there. And we've also now got a fourth City of London around All Street, which is the new financial tech, fintech centre as well. LMA is based in Canary Wharf at 11 Upper Bank Street. Why is that significant? Because that is the offices of Clifford Chance, one of the largest law firms in London. Clifford Chance is the general counsel for the LMA, so the LMA is based at their offices. The LMA was originally set up in 1996 as a trade association to try to develop standard market practice and standard documentation in these markets. The key objectives are to prepare recommended documentation, establish clear sets of agreed market practice, develop education and training purposes, collective lobbying and other network opportunities. There are now over 800 members of the LMA. Membership includes either full or associate members. Banks and other lending institutions are full members. Associate members include credit rating agencies, law firms, accountancy firms, and other smaller financial institutions or other professional parties. What is the advantage of the working contribution of the LMA? This is summarised on the outline. We have a more efficient execution of primary and secondary loan documents. Primary documentation is when we bring facilities to the market for the first time. Secondary is when we transfer them subsequently. We have increased liquidity in both the primary and secondary loan markets. We have the ability to manage loan portfolios more efficiently and effectively. We can reduce the costs through the development of a collective approach to issues. We have timely exchange of views and circulation. We have dedicated website support and other professional support to access all of the recommended documents, guidelines and provisions available. Continuing ongoing education and training, as well as the opportunity to participate in other problem solving or other issue development solutions. The basic structure of the LMA used to be focused on agency, distress, debt, documentation, loan operations, training practices and tax. And then clearly this will be evolved over time. The key objective then is to act as our principal lobby group and representative agent for all of the main participants in these markets. And we've already seen over 800 key market counterparties and agents involved in this area. I've summarised a number of the other key points and provisions about the LMA. You can look at this in further detail on the LMA website. In terms of the documentation itself, we talk about the primary documents as being the key standard provisions that the LMA prepares. The LMA started to do this in 1998. That's 2 years after its original founding. The objective was to create standard sets of provisions based on the then best market practice, which was essentially a reconciliation of all of the standard documentation prepared by the major law firms working in this area at that time. The LMA did look at alternative styles, for example, with the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, ISDA. It has a master agreement with a schedule to the master agreement that allows you to make certain revisions, and then other key support documents, including long-form confirmations, short-form confirmations, bridges, protocols, annexes and deeds for collateral purposes. We'll come back and look at all of that separately. LMA decided this was too complex. It was unnecessarily sophisticated and complicated in this area. So what the LMA decided to do was to prepare a simpler set of standard docs for each of the key areas of activity that it was involved with. A working group had been set up, basically using Clifford Chance with the General Counsel to the LMA, with Allen & Overy, one of the other principal financial law firms in the City of London. They were working with the LMA, the British Bankers Association, the BBA, and the Association of Corporate Treasurers, the ACT. The objective was to then balance lender's perspective with the borrower's perspective, with the large law firms acting on behalf of both. So it was never intended to create like a document that only benefited the banks. This was actually intended to operate on both sides of the market. So it was to reflect the interests, expectations, rights and duties, reasonable rights and duties of both the borrowers and the lenders. An initial provisional set of documents was produced in October 1999 with the final version of the draft LMA .NTR.01 was prepared, and then the final version of that was made available in October 1999. The LMA then revised the documentation in July 2000, and then subsequently again 2004, 2007, 2009, where it also added other additional support provisions such as default and market disruption clauses, as well as a separate euro and dollar swing line options within the facility. But the standard principal document is the multi-currency term and revolving facilities agreement that we are going to spend time working through so that we can understand all of the key provisions that apply in this market. In preparing the documentation, there are certain assumptions that are made, although these can be corrected in any other specific particular transaction. The Asian banks based in London, the obligors are all companies rather than countries or individuals. The obligors are incorporated in England and Wales. All facilities are unsecured in this market. The transaction is governed by English law, although we can easily amend that to New York law, which is the other most common governing law, with either New York or London being the selected jurisdictions for dispute resolution. These are just the basic assumptions behind this. We can revise all of that in practice. That is the purpose of preparing the standard documentation. In terms of format, they wanted to create a very simple, basic document with alternative provisions where necessary, but essentially a recommended set of best market practice, having regard to the documentation that was already circulating in the markets at that time. It's called a plain English approach, which means it is the simplest, most succinct, professional English that you could write. It's very easy to follow, it's very easy to read. What also tends to happen specifically is that many of the key provisions are all separately numbered with headings and subheadings. In other jurisdictions, and in specifically in New York, and we'll come on to look at standard New York documentation as well, for example, with the 1992 and 2002 master agreements prepared by the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, the English can be much more formalized, it can be much more sophisticated, and it can be much more difficult to read. You have the long paragraphs with lots of separate sentences all compacted together. The plain English approach that tends to be adopted in London, and in particular that was followed with the drafting of the LMA, is much simpler. It's much easier to follow with all of the separate provisions being separately numbered and subnumbered. Makes it very easy to understand, very easy to negotiate, very easy to change and revise them. the original objective was that when parties were using this, they would mark up the original version copied from the LMA website so that parties knew what to expect in terms of where revisions were or were not made to the standard documentation used by the LMA. In practice, what tends to happen is the largest law firms will have their own versions already, which will already come accompanied by their own sets of notes and standard clauses and provisions and timetables. So it's not quite exactly the way the LMA intended at the beginning, but it comes to the same effect in practice. What we have is a standard set of documents that everybody can follow and understand in this market, so it makes it very easy to focus on the key issues so that we can negotiate any final, more difficult, outstanding, sensitive points and then conclude the agreements, the documents, as quickly as possible so that we can make lending and credit availability as complete, large and successful as absolutely possible in these very important markets in practice. This is the multi-currency term and revolving facilities agreement, the LMA.LTR. The basic contents are set out on, what's that, pages 3 to 4. So definitions and interpretation, facilities, purpose. We can go through all of this. I personally find it easier to substructure this, to break this up, so that we can see it much more clearly in terms of what we're actually looking at. Key sets of definitions, core terms, and then also the key provisions within each of the core parts. This is the structure ordered outline that I prepared for the LMA. So we can see this very simply from this two-page outline. What we've got is this. We've got the definitions and interpretation. These are the key provisions. These are the key parties. These are the key terms. We have to define how all of the key common provisions use their meaning and application. I've just identified some of the core provisions here. We need to know the core parties. The borrower, the finance parties, the original borrowers, are also referred to as the original obligor. We'll see that separately defined. The obligor is both the borrower and the guarantor. What tends to happen in practice with these more complex deals, you'll have a company, and then you'll have other group members within the company. So there is the company, is the primary borrower, and then there'll be the other, usually subsidiaries, but other members of the group. Those are collectively referred to as the borrowers, but what will happen is that all of the borrowers will be required to guarantee each other's obligations under the agreement. So we have a separate definition of obligor, which is both borrowers and guarantors. We'll come back and look at the guarantee provisions later. Those are in section 18. These are very important. There's standard clauses, standard provisions. We need to make sure that all of the parties understand their obligations and liabilities under these. One of the key points to mention up front is that the separate companies guaranteeing each other have to be very careful that they properly and legally, as well as commercially and economically, justify why they're doing this. In law, each company is treated separately as a distinct legal person, so that the duties of the directors and the board of each company are to that company alone. It's actually contrary to the interest of one company to guarantee the obligations of another company unless it gets a benefit out of that. So what will actually happen is we will have standard clause resolutions that you will either prepare or you will ask for, which basically confirm that each company and each board considers it to be in the best interest of that company to provide these guarantees, usually specifically because it can then participate in this larger facility and obtain the borrowing at the lowest possible market rates and costs. But these resolutions, confirming both that each company participates in the borrowing and the being an obligor, as well as that each company is prepared and considers it to be in its interest to guarantee the other obligations of all of the other parties to the transaction. We will then have the finance parties, and what we will do is we will list all of these in Schedule 1. Schedule 1, Part 1 are the borrowers, Schedule 1, Part 2 are the lenders, and then Schedule 1, Part 3 are what we call the UK non-bank lenders. It's basically other non-bank institutions which are providing lending facilities in this market. We tend to separate them so all of the bank lenders are in the middle of the Schedule 1 so we can see all of the parties. What we will also do is this. We will ask for all of the company registration numbers to identify all of the companies concerned, which will be in Schedule 1, and also for all of the lenders, we will identify their proportionate payments and proportionate liabilities. For example, if we have a $100 million facility, we may have one company. We will have 9 borrowers, possibly 10 banks in the syndicate. It's a syndicated facility because the amount is large. It's not that each bank cannot lend that. Each bank certainly can. It's that they just want to spread the risk. They want to spread the counterparty risk and any other possible risks and exposures that may arise. So this is syndicated lending. In a typical example, we have one company, 9 subsidiaries, that's 10 borrowers, and then we'll have 10 lending banks. The banks don't have to lend in equal proportions. In our example, it would be 10 million each. They can lend in any proportion they like. In practice, it's usually equal, so that we can then calculate all the other interest payments and all the other mechanisms easily. The core point in law simply is this. We then have one standard document governing a large number of loan obligations. Now the question in law is, how many loans are there altogether, in total or in aggregate? If we have 10 borrowers and 10 lenders, there's going to be at least 100. However, it becomes a little more complicated than that. We will see in the facilities, with facility A and B. A is the term facility, that's for a fixed period, 10 years, 20 years. But we'll also have a shorter amount, smaller amount in the revolver, which you draw down, pay back, draw down, pay back. It's like an overdraft or a swing line facility. A swing line facility is a short overdraft used to provide funding so you can switch between other facilities. So there will be both a term loan, which will be the larger amount, let's say 80 million or 90 million in our example, and then there'll be a revolving facility, which you draw down smaller amounts and then pay back, pay back, pay back. There will be an availability period or a commitment period. That's the time during which the borrowers are able to draw down. Usually we will not leave this open for all 20 years. For example, it might be 2 years. So the borrowers will draw down for under the facility A for up to 2 years. So let's say they're drawing down possibly each month for 2 years, that's 24. So many facilities, 100 times 24, so there's 2,400 loans. Okay? Now, the facility B may be the same. It may be limited to 2 years. In practice, that may be open for the whole of the 20 years. So if you multiply that through, it actually comes out like 24,000. 12 times 20 times 100. Okay? So what's the total facilities? It's something like, it's around 26,000, over 26,000 possible loans altogether. Now what we'll see is this. There's a slight complication in terms of drafting. Each borrower, when it draws down, it submits a single utilization request. That's the drawdown statement, which will be in one of the schedules, and we'll look at that later. Legally, the single utilization request for each borrower. So each borrower, there's 10 borrowers, but the utilization request is a single document going to the agent bank on behalf of the participant banks. So you might say, well, actually, there's only one loan there because it's one borrower, although it's 10 borrowers altogether, with one utilization with regards to the collective group of banks as a whole. yes, that sounds like a clever argument, so it's not times 100, as I said before, 10 times 10. But what we'll see is this. In the key core provisions, in the facilities agreement in 2.1 and 2.2, you'll see I've marked this. So we've got obligations are several, the rights are separate and independent, and we can have separate enforcement. So what basically that does is this, it contradicts what I've just said. Even though it's a single utilisation request against all 10 banks, so you might think, well, that's just one, it actually specifies there, these loans, these lending obligations are all several, separate, and we can have separate enforcement. Why are they separate and independent? So that you don't have to have joinder. If you're going to sue under this, you might need to bring one of the other banks in with you. Because we separate them and we can have separate enforcement, it means everybody can take action. What we will see later is this, however, if one bank takes action and obtains a benefit, it actually has to share that with the other members of the syndicate. That's under the sharing clause. We'll see this. That are actually exclusions. So if one bank wants to take action, if it notifies all of the other, if it notifies the agent and all of the other banks, it invites them to participate, but they decide not to participate, and it then still earns money, generates funds, it can actually keep that without sharing. But we can look at the specific drafting for that later. So basically we have our company, we have the company's group, which are the borrowers collectively. They will also all be guarantors, guaranteeing each other, and then we have the finance parties, okay? There's a number of other key terms that we'll identify as we work through the document. Availability period, availability commitment, availability facilities, the total A and Bs during whatever drawdown period they're allowed. You have a base currency, is the currency in which the facilities are denominated, although there will always, because it's a multi-currency, you can always select other optional currencies, basically any other currency that's available. And you can do that for each interest period, and we'll see how all of this comes together. So for each interest period, and the interest periods by default are 1 month, although the borrowers can select any interest period they like. They can select 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. If they select 12-month interest periods, we will see in the clauses, payments for interest are made in arrears, at least every 6 months. So even if the borrower selects a 12-month interest period, they still have to pay interest in arrears every 6 months. If they don't make any selection, it's 1 month. That's the default provision. We've also got, I've referred to there, break costs. What are break costs? Break costs arise where one of the borrowers wants to repay early. If you repay early, creditors are generally not that pleased, simply because they then do not get interest for the whole of the duration of the interest period. You can have prepayment, and we'll see the specific clauses that govern that, but very often if you prepay, it means the banks are going to lose. However, if you do prepay, the banks then don't have to pay their borrowing costs for the residual part of the interest period. So the break cost is the difference between what the banks expected to earn for that period, 3 months or 6 months, less what they can receive by putting the money back into the interbank markets. The whole point about these markets is this. The banks don't lend deposited funds. They don't have to wait till individuals or other corporate borrowers deposit funds with them that they can on-lend in this market. That's what banking is. In these markets, because they're so large and they're so powerful, what will happen is this. Each of the lending banks will only go into the market and draw down what it needs to lend for each interest period and in each currency when the Asian bank tells that bank that a relevant utilization request has been submitted. So even though they're liable for 100 million, 10 million each, they don't actually need to have that 10 million, and they won't even go into the market and borrow that 10 million. They will only go into the market when necessary to borrow the specific amount in the relevant currency that the particular borrower asks for that specific interest period. And that will be notified by the agent bank. They will then make those funds available through what they call their facility office. That's how this market works. Basically, we're creating lending, money effectively out of nothing. That's how this operates. The banks do not even have to have a deposit base to cover this. They can simply borrow it in the interbank markets and make it available as necessary. This is how the international financial system works. So, in terms of the basic structure, we can then see we've got the facilities, the A and the B, that's the term and the revolver. We've got the purpose. Usually on the multi-currency standard lending facilities that we're looking at, there will be no restriction on the use of the funds. So therefore, we'll just delete the purpose clause. We may have a purpose clause in particular types of documents and deals where, for example, it's project finance. If we're building a power station or a hospital or a nuclear reactor or a rocket or an aeroplane, we may have a specific purpose. Usually on open interbank Euroloan lending, there's no purpose clause because we don't specify it. Even if there is, we're going to direct that no finance party has to check that that's been satisfied anyway. We have what we call the conditions for utilisation. Utilisation means drawdown. And this is quite clever, the way it's drafted. What we do is this. The conditions precedent are incorporated through the drawdown. So what the drawdown clause says is that you cannot draw down unless the conditions precedent attached in the schedule have been satisfied. So it's a condition to draw down, conditions to utilisation. So the conditions precedent are incorporated that way. So in Schedule 2, I've listed all of the key conditions precedent. Constitutional documents, board resolutions, we've mentioned already. Specimen signatures. You need specimen signatures for each of the parties signing documents. And you have to obtain this. And very often what will happen in practice is that the partner or the client will say, you know me, you've dealt with me, you're familiar with me, we've done so many deals before, that's all right, I don't need to do this. And you say, no, you do need to do it because it's in the conditions precedent and we have to have this satisfied. And I've seen disputes in law firms arise to that effect. All of this has to be confirmed. The parties signing the documents, they need to board resolutions authorising that signature, and then you have to specify sample signatures of the execution. And it's one of the key functions of young junior associates in the big law firms to collect the conditions precedent documentation and make sure this is all done properly. No excess certificates, other documentation correctness, legal opinions. In each of the countries in which we may have to enforce this, we need legal opinions as to the enforceability of both the loan agreement and the guarantees, as well as if there's any security. But in a standard Euroloan deal, it's unsecured, so there's no security. But in more complex deals, there will be, always. Process agent acceptance, so that if you're having to sue, we need to know that the process agent is an agent for service in each of the jurisdictions for each of the borrowers. And remember, these borrowers might be all around the world, and very often they'll all be in different countries. So the parent company might be in Hong Kong, and all these 9 subsidiaries could be anywhere else in the world. So we need a process agent in each jurisdiction. That's maybe relevant. Any other authorizations? Original financial statements will need upfront documentation which confirm the condition of the borrower as set out where in the information memorandum. And then we'll keep seeing how the financial provisions are built in, both in terms of the representations, the information statements, and then the continuing covenants. The way the banks can exercise most control over the activities of the borrower is simply by imposing a series of carefully drafted financial ratios. You can exercise an enormous amount of control just through the use of basic ratios. And we'll see how all of this works. What the banks want to do is this. They want to be able to protect their lending, their interest, their repayment, and have as much power and authority as legally they are entitled to exercise and discharge. But what they don't want to do is they don't want to become shadow directors. Because if the company makes any mistakes or errors and becomes liable for any type of loss under any type of provision, whether it's misrepresentation or environmental liability standards or even fraud or whatever else, the banks don't want to be liable for any misconduct. So they don't want to be shadow directors, but below being a shadow director, they want to exercise as much control as they can over the activities of the borrowers, and we can do that through financial ratios. And then you fees, costs and expenses, all that will be confirmed. We'll see later the key sets of fees are the commitment fee, the arrangement fee and the agency fee. The commitment fee is the amount that's paid to the banks, each participant lender, for making the facility available. Now that might actually seem a little unfair because the bank actually hasn't drawn those funds down yet. When the funds have been drawn down, the banks get paid their interest. And we'll come on and we'll look at that. It's down here in terms of the amounts in section 9, interest, margin, LIBOR and mandatory costs. We'll come back and look at that. But what's happening is this. The banks are going to be paid an availability or a commitment fee just by making the funds available. Even though they haven't drawn them down, they still get a fee for that because they've agreed to enter into the facility. They're taking on the liability. Once they draw down, lend the funds through the agent bank, they'll then be able to charge the full interest, but still they're entitled before that to charge a commitment fee. The arrangement fee is for the arranging bank, which is the bank at the beginning who's going to set up the syndicate. And then in very large syndicates, such as the Eurodollar deal, where there was over 100 banks, you may have a managing group, an arranging group. Might be 5, might be 10 banks, possibly. And then the agency fee is paid to the agent bank. The agency fee will be much less than the others. The arrangement fee will be a percentage of the total facility, let's say 0.5%. So 100 million, half a million for 1 month's work. So another half a million for another month's work. And then another month's work. And then you overlap them. So very quickly, you can generate 5, 10, 15, 20 million in fees in these deals. The commitment fee will be a percentage, as we've said already, of the facility to be available, but much, much, much smaller. The agency fee is for the administrative work carried out by the agent bank after the deal is up and running. The arranging bank pulls the syndicate together, drafts all the documentation, ensures that everything is signed and executed properly, and then steps away. The agent bank then administers the facility from date of signing the loan agreement for the duration of the facility for the next 20 years. So the arranging bank's only there for 1 month to put everything together and then will fall away. The arranging bank very often will agree to be a participant member, but they won't want to actually make money by lending. So what they will very often do is they will actually transfer their obligation even before the loan agreement is signed. They will bring another bank in to actually lend their 10 million. We can either do that through disclosure on an open basis, or we can do on a blind basis. So you have a blind participation where you bring someone else in to cover your obligations. If it's covering your obligations, we can only transfer rights by assignment, legal or equitable, under section 136 of the Law of Property Act 1925. If you're transferring obligations, it has to be a novation. And we'll come back and look at that. We'll see the transfer certificate. It was, I think, Schedule 5, although the revised versions have two transfer certificates in Schedules 5 and 6. One is a novation, so we can transfer obligations. The other is an assignment, whereby we only transfer rights and benefits under the documentation. So we'll get the conditions for utilisation. This is how we incorporate the conditions present. We've then got the utilisation. That's, you deliver the utilisation request, that's the drawdown, it's in a standard format which is attached at the back. And then there's a series of conditions which are specified in relation to how that operates. The borrowers can draw down under optional currencies, so they can specify the currency they want to draw down. If they don't specify, it will be in the base currency. Repayment, there's provisions on repaying A and repaying B. If you repay A, you can't draw it down again. Repay B, you repay at the end of each interest period, then you can draw down again if you wish. We have prepayment and cancellation. Banks prefer if amounts are not prepaid because they otherwise lose their interest for that. However, there are specific provisions which we have to allow for specific events, such as illegality, change of control, voluntary cancellation, voluntary prepayment. The basic obligation in these cases will be you have to cover the break costs, which is the difference between what the banks should have earned and what they can earn by reinvesting the funds back into the interbank market lending to another institution. And because these markets are so big and powerful and liquid, it is very easy to do. You can re-lend in minutes and seconds. You just put it straight back into the market and another market maker will take it up. The interest. What is the borrower going to pay? The borrower is going to pay the margin, which is the bank's profit, usually BPS, basis points. So it might be 100 basis points is 1%. It might be 200, it might be 300. We know today that, for example, the British government borrowing on the international bond markets is paying 327 basis points, 3.27%, which is high. Before summer, it was just over 100. So a typical borrower is probably going to be paying just now 400, 500, 600, possibly. That's the bank's profit. What's that on top of? It's on top of the cost of funding. So where did the banks obtain the money? They're borrowing it on the interbank markets. The interbank markets used to be denominated generally in terms of LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate. There was, however, a scandal with regards to LIBOR, principally because Barclays Bank in the United Kingdom overstated its expected borrowing charges. Why? Because it didn't want other banks and the markets to be concerned about its stability during the global financial crisis in 2008-2009. It was trying to protect the market from contagion and from collapse and protect itself. It was a legitimate cause, but it was basically illegal. It hadn't properly stated an accurate figure. The way LIBOR worked was that you basically have 16, you have a set of reporting banks. Let's say there's about 16 of them. You remove the top four, you remove the bottom four on each day, the highest numbers and the lowest numbers, and you average the rest. That's the London average interbank offered rate, which is the overnight unsecured rate that each bank would expect to be able to obtain funds from another bank at. That's how we calculated LIBOR. Because of the concerns that arose, this was then reconsidered in various commissions and reports. There was a Wheatley report. Martin Wheatley was the then chairman of the Financial Conduct Authority in London. There was a Fair Markets report as well. They decided to revise the system. So we've now moved away from almost everybody in the world using LIBOR to having separate what we call IBORs, interbank offered rates, and now even more important, what we call, I think it's FRRs, free lending rates. So we've gone from LIBOR, standard LIBOR, to various IBORs in different countries. So you would have one in Shanghai, one in Hong Kong, one in America, to actually what we call, risk-free rate. It's called a risk-free rate. Risk-free rate, RFRs. The most common RFRs now in London is called SONIA. That's the Sterling Overnight Interest Rate. In New York, it's called SOFRA. That's the Secured Overnight Lending Rate. And in Europe, it's called ESTER, E-S-T-E-R, which is the European Short-Term Rate. So everybody now uses these these risk-free rates rather than the old IBORs, which replaced the previous LIBOR. So each of the main financial centres has a standard interest rate. What we will see is in this specific version is probably the Strauss going to refer to LIBOR. Now it's SONIA. But what actually happened in practice was when the LME looked at this, it wanted to come up with a compound SONIA. So you'll see reference to this. What is compound SONIA? Compound SONIA is the average SONIA rate for the interest period. So the interest period is 3 months. You calculate SONIA for 3 months and you take the average figure. And you do that for the 3 months before the next interest period, and you have a short lag period, 2, 3, 4 days, maybe up to 5 days. Why? Just to give the Asian bank time to calculate or obtain that. So things are now based on not LIBOR, but these risk-free rates. The most common are SONIA in London, SOFR in New York, ESTER in Europe. And then you also have, I think, Tibor. Cybor. Tibor is Hong Kong. Cybor will be Shanghai. And then the equivalent in Hong Kong as well. So, what's the borrower we're going to pay? The borrower is going to pay the margin, which is the bank's profit, plus the bank's cost of funds, plus minimum is going to pay what we call the mandatory cost. The mandatory cost are regulatory charges that the authorities will impose in each of the main financial centres. In London, it used to just be the Bank of England. Now it's the Bank of England and the authorities, the FCA. So the way it used to be calculated was this. It's the total amount of lending that the bank's doing in any financial centre. So the Bank of England's charge, it was 0.11% of the bank's total sterling eligible liabilities. Sterling eligible liabilities, and we'll come back and look at this when we see the definitions in the actual document. So 0.11%, very small. And even then, that's of the bank's total lending in the market, so all the borrower actually has to pay is the proportion of that. So a very small amount. The supervisory authorities, the FCA, they also charged a very small amount based on the target base, which was equal to the modified eligible liabilities, something very similar. It's the total deposit base of the bank, the lending in this market. The ECB now has a separate formula. There used to be standard drafting in the LMA, but because this became much more complex in practice, because all the different authorities were imposing different charges, although they're very small, you basically now just use whatever the standard clause is for that particular market, depending upon which banks are involved. So there'll be an ECB clause, there's a Bank of England clause, there's a UK clause, and whatever other relevant country may be involved. So that's the mandatory cost. It's very small, but still, because it's a charge the lenders have to pay, the borrower has to pay. Now what you simply will then do is this. You are going to look at all of the other provisions in the document, and you're going to link them all together. So what we're going to see is this. The borrower is going to pay margin, the risk-free rate, the RFR, and the mandatory cost. But what it's also going to pay on the other side, it's going to pay any tax gross up and indemnities in 13. It's going to pay any increased costs in 14. It's going to pay other indemnities in 15. So you just draw lines on your page. So from here, you just draw lines up. So 13, tax gross up and indemnities, increased costs, other indemnities, mitigation. That's the obligation by the borrowers, the lenders, to reduce these liabilities under the earlier provisions, but also 17 other costs and expenses. And then within each of these, you'll see 1, 2, 3 separate provisions. So how many separate items is the borrower paying altogether? It's not 3 and 9, it's about 12, if not 14 or 16. So that's how we can see how these documents come alive. Okay, you just start drawing lines. And you'll see in 13 sub-provisions, 14 sub-provisions, 15 sub-provisions, and then again in 17. The borrower's going to pay all of this because that's the purpose of the facility. The borrowers want to draw down this money. They want to apply it, use it, develop it, make profit from it, but they have to cover the bank's costs in so doing. If there's any changes to the interest rate, we have specific provisions governing that. Usually it's simply what we call the screen rate. So we will have the screen rate. It was LIBOR, then IBOR, now it's the FR, the risk-free rate, the RFR. Sonia, Sofer, Esther. You get it on a screen, so we call it the screen rate. You see it on the screen, there it's there. If that's not there, we will look for other rates, and if that's not available, we will negotiate. The agent bank will negotiate with the borrowers, and I think they have up to 30 days to agree a suitable calculation for the determination of how much is due. Okay? So you have alternative provisions under each clause to make sure that everything can be covered. We then have the fees we've already mentioned, the commitment fee, the arrangement fee, and the agency fee. You've then got tax gross up and indemnities. We'll go back over this little more in more detail later, but let's just mention this now. Tax grossing up. The lenders always expect to get paid the full amount without any separate charges to tax that they would be liable, apart from corporation tax on their profit at the end of the financial year. What very often happens in these deals, specific countries, jurisdictions, or financial centres may impose a withholding tax. And that means that the borrower has to deduct an amount and pay it to the inland revenues. So the banks receive less than they expect. So you need to gross up so that the banks receive the larger amount that they would have received had it not been for this withholding. So you gross up. It's just a simple element of the additional charges that the borrowers have to cover. When you gross up, however, you don't gross up by adding on the tax deducted, because you have to gross up to the larger amount so that when you calculate the tax and deduct it, you get the same original amount. If, for example, it's 100 somethings, $100,000 or $100 million, and there's a 10% withholding tax, what do you gross up 100 to? If there's 100 payment, 10% withholding, it's not 10%, because 10% wouldn't cover everything the bank was expecting to receive. You actually have to gross up 100 to 111 so that when you take 10% of 111, that's 11, take away 111, leaves 100. Otherwise, if it was 10 and it was 100, if it was 100, if it was 110 and you deducted that, the banks would receive 90 something. They would receive less than the full 100 that they expected. When you gross up, it's the larger amount that you need to gross up to, so that when you take the 10% of the bigger amount, that leaves exactly what the borrowers were expecting to receive. So 100 goes up to 111, it doesn't go up to 110 if there's a 10% withholding. Any other increased costs? Increased cost claims, exceptions. So there's tax deductions, there's tax indemnities, there's mandatory costs, currency indemnity, other indemnities, and we can look at the detail in these provisions. You can build them in yourself. The borrowers can pay slightly lesser amounts because the lenders are subject to a duty to reduce, so they have to try and mitigate, but it's drafted very much in favour of the lenders, and we'll look at the specific clause and we'll see how this operates in practice. We then have guarantee provisions. We've then got the representations and the warranties. So we've got the separate reps in 19, and then you've got the other provisions, information, representations and warranties in 20. So reps and W's, 19 and 20. We've then got the financial covenants and the general undertakings. So the covs are basically 21 and 22. They're just back to front. So the covs are 21 and 22. The reps are 19 and 20, and the CPs are in Schedule 1, which are incorporated through the utilisation request we looked at before. You've then got the events of default, all the standard core provisions that we'd expect. Two key provisions to note are the cross default. You need to check your cross default, and you need to check your MAC clause. On the general covenants, you'll also always look at the negative pledge clause. The merger disposals provisions, these are always in general standard provisions, but standard terms. But you'll always check the negative pledge, you'll check the cross default, you'll check the max. I've provided on the system some possible drafting. The financial covenants will not be in the documents because these are prepared by the accountants. The lawyers don't draft these, but the lawyers need to understand them. When you're doing the deal, you need to be able to discuss all the different types of races which have applied. Again, I've given you sample clauses, and I look at this separately in the further paper that I've published on. Project finance. So we have the standard default provisions. We can change the lenders, we can bring other lenders in, let lenders retire through accession, and we can change the obligors and the guarantors. We will see there's resignation of a guarantor in 25.7. There's no specification of any conditions. It says the lenders have to agree, but it doesn't specify what the clauses are or any conditions are. What we'll see above is that the borrowers have to agree to let lenders change, but there can be no unreasonable withholding of consent, including specifically if that would only lead to an extra cost or charge. We will see when that turns round, when the guarantor wants to leave, the banks aren't subject to an equivalent obligation. So these are the small provisions we're looking for, small points of detail. We need to understand the role of the agent bank and the possible liability of the agent bank and the arranger. There's a number of key provisions in 26, especially 1 up to sort of 6, 7 and 8. So we'll look at that. The core clauses, the key provision is, the key point is this: the agent and arranger need to limit their liability. If anything goes wrong and the borrowers don't repay, the other syndicate members cannot sue each other because they're all in the same position. So who can they sue? They can only sue the arranging bank or the agent bank. So when we're drafting this, we need to make sure the arranging bank and the agent bank are protected. And we will see, for example, that it says the duties, the role of the arranger in 26.3, that specifies that the arranger has no legal obligations of any form whatsoever under this document. But also, there's a number of other repeat provisions when that applies to both the agent bank and the arranger. The arranger is not subject to any duty to this. It's not a fiduciary, for example. It's not subject to that, 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 or that. And we'll see how this operates so we can understand the legal relationship between the parties involved. There's a conduct clause, 27. The arranger and the agent bank and other syndicate members can engage in any other business dealing with the obligors. Then you've got the sharing clause. If any lender receives an additional amount which wasn't made available to the others, it has to be shared. Specifically, if it takes action, as we mentioned before, it has to share that, although there are conditions if it does invite other banks to participate in the action to come in and then they decide not to, it can actually keep the results in that case. We've then got the payment mechanics. These are basically just how the agent bank will administer all the provisions. These are all in standard terms, standard clauses. You just need to check them, so you'd read through these very quickly. We have set-off. There's no set-off by the obligors, which means that they cannot offset any other obligations due to any of the lending banks. However, that's 29.6, but the opposite then applies in 30, so the lenders can set off anything that's due to the obligors. So if one of the lenders has a claim against one of the companies and the company tries to draw down, the lender can say, I'm setting off this amount that you owe me separately. Turn that round. If the bank owes the obligor, it can do that. So we deny set off by the obligors. And remember, obligor is a borrower and a guarantor under 29.6. But when we turn that round in 30, the lenders protect their set off. What we're going to see when we look at the International Swaps and Derivatives Association documentation, we're going to have netting within the transaction, and then we're going to save set off outside the deal, the financing structure. Standard notice provisions, standard calculation provisions, no invalidity in the event of some clauses being partially invalid, no waivers. Specific provisions governing consents, counterparties, you can have as many counterparty documents as we wish, and then the standard governing law clause. And we'll look at the drafting of this. Basically, we will need to select a governing law which is going to apply to determine the rights and obligations of all of the parties under this document. If we do not do that, the courts will have to look at this and try and work out from their opinion which jurisdiction has got the most closest, which legal system is the most closest relationship with the transaction. You never leave that uncovered. We will always specify. In practice, it's usually New York or England, New York or English law. And then we also have a separate clause, the jurisdiction. Which courts can consider this? It's always non-exclusive, because in case law that's determined that you cannot have exclusive jurisdiction clauses. So we'll, again, very often pick either London or New York, simply because if something goes wrong, you need a reliable jurisdiction and legal system that's going to provide the awards you need and then allow for the execution. But when it comes to the execution, you then have to get back to all these other separate jurisdictions in which all the borrowers may be based. But that's why you'll have the legal opinions to confirm that all of this is enforceable later. And then you have the schedules. We have the original parties, obligors, and then the lenders, and then the UK NBLs, non-bank lenders, 1, 2 and 3 in Schedule 1. We have the conditions precedent in Schedule 2. We have the utilisation, the drawdown in 3. The mandatory cost formula, it was an LMA standard, but now they've removed it simply because it's become too complex, so we can get other standard document prepared elsewhere. All the law firms will have this available. There's an accession letter for parties becoming new parties. There's a resignation letter for parties leaving. And then compliance certificates, where we need compliance certification of key issues that will be in the CPs, possibly the reps or the cuts. And then existing security has to be listed if we don't want to breach a negative pledge. And then we have standard form confidentiality, undertakings in 10, timetables in 11. The transfer certificate was in 5. We will see this as a novation. But now, under the revised version, there's a novation and an assignment. If you understand all of that, you understand the most important lending document available in the markets, and you can understand all of the key transactions which are conducted in all of these markets. All of this has core key provisions with the financials, the obligations, and the defaults. And if you can understand all of the key rights and entitlements, have a general sense of the nature of the sort of clauses which are generally imposed in practice, very quickly you can look for excessive provisions, unfair provisions, unreasonable provisions, or gap provisions, so that you can mark up, revise this, and produce a perfect document which is going to secure your party's interests, which benefits all parties to this. We need to ensure that this is as well drafted as we can get, and that it's properly executed and fully enforceable in practice. That's the objective of using the standard documentation, to ensure that we can obtain very effective, clean documents, full execution, proper execution, and then succeed just having the most effective transactions which are not subject to challenge possible in these markets, which means the markets themselves are able to lend as much as possible, make as many funds available as possible on a continuing regular basis, which reflects the expectations of all of the parties in the markets.